Hare Krishna.
Thank you. Mr. Pinnell, any questions?
Yes, I have. Thank you. Dr. Dupree, were you here during Dr. Scarf's book certificates?
I was watching by audio visual link, but it was only on from the Tuesday, so I didn't, not the Monday.
Okay. The point that you hear about the trends in water quality that you talked about going the wrong way for E. coli and Waikato. And about flat lines and all the other contaminants?
No, but I've read the evidence.
Okay, thank you. Just interested in picking up on point Mr. Conway quoted before, that you see a preference for riparian planting to improve water quality outcomes.
Oh, yes, the riparian planting is more so about sort of habitat as opposed to contaminants. So it's
okay, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. As a farmer, I worry about riparian planting for this season, and I'd like your feedback to, as a scientist, to see whether I've got any reason to be fearful. And that is animal behaviour. In the absence of riparian planting, stock like to camp on hilltops and ridges, and they're not particularly well house trained, so there's a lot of contaminant deposited there. As far away from the stream as possible with good long lengths of grass filtering below. Establish trees in the riparian zone. I fear that stock camps will be transferred down there because stock like shade and like wind shelter, and so then we'll end up transferring the deposition of contaminants right close to the spring where there's not particularly good filtering. Have you got a view on that?
Yeah, and again, it's from a sort of a technical perspective. We're sort of thinking about what we're sort of trying. I assume what, you know, when the public want better water quality, I generally take that to assume they want more things that are more those tangible measures of things like that, like stream health, aquatic life. And so, in terms of a large body of work, you know, from Newell and probably the Nordics, you know, that's from the 2000s, and certainly a very detailed and probably the most comprehensive couple of documents are from the Department of Conservation on riparian restoration. They've all, for two decades now, kind of said that the single, there's a disproportionate benefit of having riparian vegetation shading just even in the streams. So if you have these productive catchments, just even having those riparian areas that are providing shade and then stabilising the banks, and that shade then sort of even provides a lot more, but resilience for the stream with the nutrients, because if it's shaded, that's one reason you get full sunlight hitting the bed. That's another change from what's happened from native streams to pastoral streams. So that planting, you could be saying, I don't know whether it's anecdotal or whether it's, you know, whether you definitely know that if we had planted riparian corals, just like they have in Taranaki, a good example of a regional wide sort of one where they put close to 7 million trees on dairy land around all these sort of streams, as to whether or not that issue, that's theory though, that it's just dairy land that is in Taranaki, but if that issue about would materialise, you would have this big scale problem, or whether if you provide another shade trees, do they go to a one where there could be a small riparian planting of just hedges, because smaller streams might have small shrubs and all that sort of thing. So so I don't know about those particular concerns you have, but I guess I'm sort of more directed by the quite sort of strong evidence base around how riparian planting is, well, I think certainly in terms of Roman pastoral productive sort of system, it's sort of seen as the single best, or the way in which you have the biggest improvement on sort of freshwater outcomes for streams. In terms of the sort of aquatic life, the sediment, the shade of the stream being the lower temperatures, which is also quite important for the dissolved oxygen.
I lead the local catchment management group, and this is an issue that we're grappling with. Recognise all those other benefits that PC1 is focused on for contaminants at this stage. So the particular focus for us, short term anyway, is for contaminants. And, if you've got nothing more you can add with respect to those four contaminants, we'll move on.
I will move on.
Thank you. The other question I have is, I accept that alternatives cannot be as good as exclusion at a theoretical level. At a practical level, it's not quite fair to, I think, to assume that there are possibly no adverse effects of fencing where it's too steep to fence. So the more realistic scenario is, how does the comparison compare in a hillscape where it's too steep to fence? So there we've got issues bare surfaces, if there's any benching to be done for riparian fencing. Even after that initial stage, there's likely to be bare cattle tracking beside the fence, especially if that fence is on a steep slope or any slope at all, because it just provides a natural course. And where it hasn't been benched, I've seen plenty of evidence of trampling at that point. And all those things result in loss of sediment, and they also concentrate flow, so concentrate discharge of phosphates and pathogens. Do you basically accept the scenario that when we're comparing alternatives to fencing, we should have that sort of scenario in mind?
Yeah, and just to clarify, any of my sort of technical opinions are supposed to come across as offensive to, you guys are having to fence, and I, like I say, mine is a technical viewpoint, and even I would accept it's just like production forestry. You look at the landscape when they harvest, and there's a huge amount of sediment that's disturbed, you know, sort of thing. And so, 3 to 5 years is a lot of sediment coming off, but when you look across a harvesting cycle of 30 years, generally exotic forestry have water quality that resemble closer to a native forest than to pasture. They have better in terms of turbidity and all that type of thing. So, water quality is good because there is that initial disturbance. And so, the reason I'm using that analogy is that even if there's a disturbance to put in a fence line, it is not going to be continuing to generate sediment when you bench it and all that. So I don't believe there will be that. There could be an initial pulse, but in the grand scheme of long-term water quality, I don't believe that it would be something that would override the benefits that are achieved through that fencing. And then as for, even if there is some trampling along fence lines, and there could be a little bit more sediment coming in certain points, it's whether or not I don't believe that that's going to be more significant than the damage that's done from stock breaking the banks down and actually disturbing the bed. So I still think, accepting those points that you're making, but on balance from reading just my understanding of kind of the literature, the books, but that's my opinion.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Pennell. afternoon, Dr. Dupree.
Good afternoon.
You're a signatory to the joint witness statement of Freshwater.
Yes, I am.
And at question 16 on page 401, point 0012, you agreed that the TNNTP target attribute states in the main stem of the Waikato River should be treated as interim values?
Are you meaning that long-term targets may be adjusted in time?
Yes. Well, I wanted to ask you what you meant by that. Under important notes here.
I think we all know that the main stem is treated. Sorry, that's what we're doing. You know, the TN and TP end-year targets in the plan are based on, you know, in terms of down in the lower part of the river, you know, so because it was decided to treat the river as a lake, that's why we've got the chlorophyll A phytoplankton and phytoplankton, which I would recall, which I consider to be like a response attribute, that's my terminology. And then we have the other tables, 3 and 4 attributes, compulsory attributes, which is TN and TP, and those are sort of generally kind of set to be providing for chlorophyll A. So if you normally want to have a B band or whatever, 5 equates to, then you take the equivalent band from those attribute tables. So that's what TN is, the 500. And then similarly, I think I can't quite recall the upper FMU, it's 350, I think, isn't it, or 300?
So
those ones, I would assume that we're actually going to still be calling the river a lake, and those are compulsory attributes for a lake, a TN. I would think that would probably be, whether that's revised, I don't know what it would be revised to, unless another band was sort of selected, or whether it's decided that because it's not a lake, they can actually choose a different number. But at the moment, that was set by that. I think the TP might have been had a little bit more as the one that had more uncertainty, because that was derived as part of expert conferencing from the previous 2019 one with Dr. Cox, who was representing RB for that. I think he did a lot of the modelling there. And that was how it revised that number that was higher, because I think it was 25. I can't remember what the number was in the total phosphorus NPSFM table. But that was actually, I think, when they looked at the background load, it was actually a not achievable target. And so I think then looking at relationships between chlorophyll A and total phosphorus in the river, they derived those numbers of, I think the current one that's in there of 38. And so I think that's the one that maybe has that uncertainty, that if we weren't driving towards the chlorophyll A targets, that's when maybe I think they might have to be readjusted. Okay, well, that was my understanding of it.
All right, okay, thank you.
Sorry, that was a bit long.
No, that's fine. Then we come to question 17, which is, are the nitrate, nitrogen and the binary of nitrogen target attribute states and tributaries adequate to achieve ecosystem health? And under matters of agreement, you've agreed that they were set to address toxicity effects and other components of ecosystem health, e.g. ecological processes, aquatic life, etc., were not used to set target attribute states and may require lower concentrations of N and P than toxicity. So you'll recall that discussion right now.
I think that was one where there wasn't much discussion on.
Right, okay. Then in Dr. Scarsbrook's the vital evidence, he talks about, at paragraph 24, there are significant advances made over the last 2 or 3 years related to relationships between nutrient concentrations and ecosystem health outcomes. And he talks about some work that the regional council's doing with Dr. Snelder, Cathy Kilroy and Doug Booker, that's at footnote 4, to derive nutrient criteria for periphyte and biome subjectives. Paragraph 24 of Dr. Scar's book's rebuttal. I just wanted, and if you're not able to answer this, then do let me know, but do you have a handle on the proportion to which the nitrate reductions currently expressed in PC1 would need to be altered to cater for ecosystem health as opposed to toxicity in the next plan change?
I certainly don't know it off the top of my head, but I certainly know from being involved in plan change, Tuatahi, I've typically had a lot of involvement with Tom Snell there, Dr. Snell, sorry. And of course, you know, I'm probably too intimate or too familiar with the purified and lookup tables, which are going to be one of the default measures that councils will take to initiate, because that's that primary response, a primary trophic response in the hard bottom stream will be the algae growing, and so that's why there's those a large number of tables in the 2022 document of MFB. So yes, so I'm totally familiar of how they will go, but then I'm also aware that in those tables, it's one of the first documents that we have now that actually shows that shading, you basically have 4 times higher nitrogen standards. So often when you look at shading tables, if you have shaded pastoral streams, the threshold can be set 4 times higher. And those numbers actually do go, in some cases, depending on what level you're trying to achieve, higher than the nitrate toxicity. So I totally take the point, normally they will be lower, but even sometimes, depending on the stream, you can, even with national guidance, be taking numbers that are actually similar or comparable to the nitrate.
Oh, thank you, that's interesting. So now if I take you to question 25 in the JWS question number.
25?
Yes, and that's 401.0016. And the JWS fresh water now.
Yes.
So you've agreed that it's necessary to manage both total nitrogen and total phosphorus in the main stem of the Waikato River. And you would have considered the rebuttal evidence of Dr. Daniel Fisherman.
Yes.
And he talks about the difficulty in predicting the nutrient chlorophyll A relationships with various sites in the Waikato River for the future, and whether total nitrogen or total phosphorus will be the determining factor given. And this is at paragraph 4.6 of his evidence. Various variables such as climate change, the impacts of invasive species, and possible increases in water clarity. That, can you comment on that, because your evidence in chief seemed to suggest that you needed to manage phosphorus more than nitrogen?
The context for the evidence in chief around that point was that there was talk about TN concentrations have increased since 2014, and was that understanding back when it was done that there was a lot of work around the volume to come. So because there was intensification that pretty much plateaued around 2014, it was kind of, I thought, from my reading, that it was quite expected that there was going to be some increases that continued to reflect, that intensification. So the context there was that if you've got TN increasing, and I think from Bill Lang's 30-year, which are quite, it's hard to sort of dispute those really long-term 30-year sort of trends. And so he's showing important deteriorations in TN at probably six of the main stem sites, and at the same, maybe not the exact same, but certainly five or six sites in the river, he's actually where you've actually got the most pronounced improvement is from phytoplankton, chlorophyll A. And so, and at the same time, it's about four sites in the main stem have important improvements in total phosphorus. And so it's that empirical data. And so that work that Dr. Daniels refers to in that document, the complexities of it, I mean, my read on it was actually, is that it's actually quite difficult to, and it's easy to misinterpret information from five-day incubation experiments around what is the limiting nutrient, whereas the work that I was referring to was by Dr. Berger, who's a NIWA lake scientist, and he looked at 20 years of data across 10 sites looking for empirical relationships. And he concluded there's abundant evidence that it's, and I think the important thing is that it's not always, as phytoplankton or chlorophyll A is primarily controlled by total phosphorus and not total nitrogen. So that's why I was, you know, verbatim using their ones. And then even those reports went to the TLG, and then nutrients and phytoplankton chlorophyll A report, a WIC report, you know, even in bold it says, this is evidence that chlorophyll A is mainly responding to TP, not TN, in the Waikato River main stem, mainly. And then it says under current conditions. And all those are quite important, so things may change, but at the moment it does seem that phytoplankton growth in the river is controlled primarily by total phosphorus. So, of course, you have to control TN because we've got TN targets, we've got maybe 600, 630 at the lower part of the river, and we need to have 500. So it's explicit that we have to still manage for total nitrogen. So that wasn't the intent of my evidence to say that we didn't need to manage for total nitrogen, or for nitrogen.
Okay. Oh, no, that's good. Thank you for explaining that.
You're welcome.
I just one more question on dissolved oxygen. And this is for JWS at question 11. Page 401.0010. So, Ms. McCarthy's proposed, hasn't she, a dissolved oxygen target attribute state for the lower Waikato EPMU, both interim and long term. And you are in the matters of agreement, and I'll just go to number 3 there. There is uncertainty around the attribute's applicability to low-lying sites, which may be naturally lower in DO. And the recommendation is for DO to be implemented as a monitoring requirement, with the bottom line set as the trigger value for management intervention. So I presume that remains your view, first of all.
Yes, and that was one of the corrections I did. In my rebuttal, I did say that I thought it was better in the rebuttal. I said about it being I was more comfortable with it being a narrative attribute state, only because it's like if you use a national bottom line and you throw C bands against everything, we know that there's a lot of sites that are A band, and so it was kind of like, did we want to be? I'm not saying that they would be degraded, but it was just whether it was meaningful to sort of put a C band on them. So that was the difference, and so but acknowledging that importance, yes, that's why I had changed it, not a thought. So I think the only difference is that I think they should be placeholders at AED targets, not interim. So that's the only slight, if it's a slight nuance. So.
Yeah, okay, thank you. When it says we recommend DO be implemented as a monitoring requirement with the bottom line set as a trigger value for management intervention, has that been drafted into any of Fonterra or Dairy New Zealand's proposals? I don't think I've seen it drafted.
I must. Sometimes when you're, especially online with a lot of people on these ones, I wasn't sure as to whether, you know, it was like when we used to have macro invertebrates and they were a monitoring requirement in the 2017. And then if you read some of the OIA documents, those monitoring requirements actually then sort of became Appendix 2B action plan attributes. So I don't know whether, I think maybe it was like Dr. Scarsbrook that was, you know, writing some of these words. And so I was assuming, you know, as to whether that was that. But so I don't know what the monitoring requirement is. I'm assuming that's maybe built into, because I think later on he speaks to that there's a big piece of work going on at WRC that's rolling out summertime monitoring of dissolved oxygen. So that's what it's referring to, and that's going to be picking up those wherever they find a low DO event. I guess that would then trigger some kind of action. But I can't really expand on them before. It just seemed like I agreed with it, but I wasn't sure how it was being operationalised.
All right, no, that's fine. Thank you. Those were all my questions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. When I read the joint statement for you water quality scientists, I think I saw a high degree of common ground. And so I wanted to ask you, it's right, isn't it, that you you didn't participate in all the questions relating to CBP?
No, I can't think of the question on top of my head, but it was the one about rotations, and I just don't understand how the rotations work. So I limited my input to just expansion, you know, if there's going to be useful contaminants.
Yeah, and one thing you did agree to, I think, is that you expected that even expanding CBP, for instance, into an area of pastoral, if you're replacing pastoral, I think you expected that would reduce E. coli losses to local water bodies. Is that right?
Could you take me to the point?
Yes, so question 50, point number 3. I think you participated in this one. Is that right?
Yes. Well, yeah. I'm not an excluded on it.
Yeah.
I've signed up to it.
Yeah. And point 3 is that where CBP expansion occurs and replacement of pastoral land uses, we expect a reduction in E. coli losses on local water bodies, although not quantified.
And that's very much, I don't think there's any data to sort of show that. It's just that logic that the major source of E. coli, say in an agricultural sense, is ruminants,
yeah,
and those ruminants aren't there, then you'd hope that. Although, I just would preface that, because I was trying to look for some information, and I did notice in the area normalised there in Appendix C of Dr. Jane Crystal's evidence, all the E. coli area normalised bars are actually higher than pastoral. So I don't know whether that's just an anomaly of small areas, but that wasn't consistent with lower E. coli.
Yeah, but I guess nevertheless you felt that it was sensible enough that E. coli would reduce in principle.
Yes, and then again, yeah. The only caveat there is just as you can expand and you don't have much of an impact in an FNU scale, because it's a small change in nitrogen relative to a large catchment.
Yeah.
The same would probably apply for benefits of E. coli because you're a small area, so I guess you can't sort of have you taking it too, you can't have massive improvements while not having any deterioration. So I imagine reasonably modest.
Yeah, and on that expansion of CBP at that FNU scale or subcatchment, that was another one where I think you acknowledged that you expected the increase in contaminants to be small.
Sorry, what question was that?
Well, at point one.
Oh, where same question?
Yeah, where it says that whilst the overall increase appears small, 0.5% at the catchment scale,
yes.
then you explain, well, that doesn't consider the risks on local streams or aquifers. So if we just put to one side the local, you can see that, were you happy enough with Mr. Easton for Hort's analysis about that 0.5%, at least at that big picture scale?
And I guess that's 80 tonnes. It's 80 tonnes versus probably, 11,000 tonnes that's in the river. So if you're a small land use, no matter what you do, it's going to be... That's the danger of the argument, is that you can't actually... It's always going to be a small impact because it's a relatively small in relation to that. And that's why it's with that 80 tonnes at the local scale or whatever we... I don't mean a sub-catchment, as in how they've been defined in the plan, but it's just that where you might have local, smaller subcatchment scales where that, or a portion of that 80 tonnes actually does then have a meaningful impact on groundwater or surface water.
And that's what you're worried about, isn't it?
Correct.
That not the FMU or the subcatchment, but that even more detailed,
I'm worried about the FMUs and all that sort of thing, specifically for...
It's that local... local impact.
It is that local impact, but in that grander scheme, when you think of other land uses having to make reductions, 80 tonnes sucks up a lot of reductions from other land uses. So at that FMU scale, if you're trying to get a direct... My understanding is PC1 wants to achieve direction of travel. You get direction of travel by as many people, hopefully everybody, going down or staying the same, but as soon as you have some ups, then you've got to do more work to then sort of, if someone comes up, then there's got to be more work done to sort of absorb that cost. And so any ups do have an impact on achieving either interim or 80-year targets at an even new scale.
Sure, but in terms of the quantum of the impact, you're reasonably satisfied that that sort of 0.5%, 80 tonnes. It was a reasonable assessment of that quantum.
The only thing from a technical point of view is that it's like if it's 80 tonnes in the wrong direction, then it's got to be seen as significant. In terms of significant with respect to the direction of travel, not significant, I won't say it's significant necessarily in relation to the 11, I can't remember the exact number, 11 or 12,000 tonnes at Port Waikato. But it's, like I say, it's. I think sports McCabbage gets to be a bit of a moot point, because if a very small land use is changing, it's always a small land use is going to have it's still going to appear small, and like I say, the whole point is that's not where there's those two key parts. There's the key parts that you're not contributing to the overall direction of travel of achieving the reductions that we're looking for at FMU and subcatchment sort of scales. And then there's that real concern that then in CUP areas, that we do know we have groundwater concentrations in the up to 20, and some of those are surface water streams, we have spring heads sort of coming up. So we know that there's local impacts from that, because we know that they leach, even if they, in that modelling, I think, from Mr. Easton, I think the when it was replacing theory, I think it was 40 to 45 kilograms more nitrogen per hectare. So it's not insignificant, when you consider the nitrogen losses, even at the land parcel scale that you're replacing.
Yeah, in terms of this idea of if you're increasing at all, you're not contributing to the overall improvement. I guess that isn't the case if what you're replacing is, for example, pastoral, which we've discussed just before. Right, you are contributing in a sense because your E. coli is dropping.
Well, that's what I mean. That's why I don't know whether you've seen Appendix C of Jane Crystal's evidence, and that was based on SANS 2017 Hort report. And so, say, area normalised losses didn't seem lower for E. coli, which was odd, but that's why I don't know whether. It seems like people in principle are saying, well, if you don't have ruminants on there and growing vegetables, then you must have less E. coli. But do you have any? Oh, I can't ask you questions, can I?
Well,
Okay, so I'm not aware that there's actually, it's been quantified that the export coefficients of E. coli from CBP are a magnitude, or I don't know what huge means. You're saying, because you sometimes use the term huge improvement. So I don't know that what data is available that I can see to understand these improvements.
Okay, well, if we can put aside this replacing pastoral use example, and if I can offer you another instance where it's not quite right to say, oh, well, if you're adding any CBP, you're not contributing, you're not playing your part. And it's this. Isn't it the case that at the moment, not under PC1, but under the current situation rules, you actually don't need consent to undertake CBP, and it's not restricted to subcatchments or even the FMU, right?
I don't know.
Okay, but if that was so, can you see that moving to a PC1 world where these things are controlled, discretionary, that's likely to actually improve water quality as well, even for expanding CBP, I guess, compared to the status quo? Can you see that? The merit in that?
Can you just reword that? Or just...
Sure, so I guess if PC1 goes through as it's been drafted, there's going to be improvements in water quality with CBP expanding compared to if we didn't have PC1 at all, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that's my issue, is that I don't understand. I'm not sure as to when you're going to have, I mean, if all things being the same, we were just going to have existing CBP and then we're going to bring in more stringent standards or something to mod it, and then I would agree. And yes, bringing in PC1 with those measures to control that, but I think we've kind of seen, even in the taking the dairy analogy, where we've had a lot of efforts to do things, to improve things, a lot of what's happened up until 2015 has been against the background of intensification, and often that intensification has meant that even when we're trying to, when we've got improved GFP or good farming practices and doing things like planting and stuff, there's some things like nitrogen that have still gone up because we haven't been able to offset that. Mm-hmm. And so I don't quite understand how, even with PC1, if you enable a land use that leaches at least twofold higher than say dairy that was going to replace, I don't see how that could. If you're losing more nitrogen and nitrogen needs to be managed, I can't see how PC, if you had PC1, how it's going to address that sort of issue of those increases.
Yeah. Are you familiar, though, with the FMP regime that's proposed for CBP?
At all.
If there were requirements that local effects, for example, CBP, do need to be considered, identified, and dealt with, are you saying that would assuage some of your concerns about expanding CBP?
I think from those sort of surface runoff ones, and I'm assuming I've sort of seen technical manuals on silt retention and all that kind of thing. So when you've got those kind of mitigations, my challenge is the slippery contaminant called nitrogen, and that sort of just goes down through the soil. So I'm not sure how you can, if you've just got a land use that leaches more, and you need to, and that's what the leaching rates are. And from Mr. Easton's evidence, it said it was leaching 40 to 45 kilograms more across those areas than dairy. I don't believe there's anything you can do to address that increase.
Okay, so you're not aware of your management techniques or processes for CBP that might help in that regard?
Will certainly not prevent an increase if it replaced, like say, dairy, if it leaches two times as much. I'm not aware that they can bring that leaching back to be the same as the land use. assuming this that he's going to be able to do the model.
If I can ask you about your concern about if crop rotation is allowed to happen at the FMU scale, the bigger scale, rather than sub-catchments. I think you're saying your worry is that increases the potential for greater concentration of CVP in specific areas. Is that the gist of your concern?
The board experts are the ones in the joint witness statement, not in the joint witness statement, but during expert conference. They
just have to take care, I think, not to
set
as conferencing, just for technical legal reasons. But I guess I'm asking about
my understanding is that they do tend to concentrate.
Yes. Well, can I offer you a new perspective on why CVP rotation at the FMU scale might actually be no bad thing? But let me try. Do you understand that if you're rotating over a larger area, that might actually allow a greater rest time for the soil?
Sorry, and we're still talking, this is about, because remember I stepped out of the question about just rotations. I was only talking about, if you're talking about increasing.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to compare two situations. One where you're allowed to rotate just within your sub-catchment as a control activity, and the other world is where you can do that at the larger FMU scale. And I'm saying, do you think that if you were allowed to rotate your crops over a bigger area, you can see that might actually allow the soil more time to rest in between plants. Aware of that?
I'm not aware of the process of doing this at the top of the
right.
So I'm not sure I can really add much to this line.
Okay then. But even in a general way, can you see some merit in if you're allowed to rotate over a larger land area, then you're spreading the same amount of CVP over a larger area, and so you can see there's likely to be less concentration, not more.
My understanding was that they do tend to concentrate, so even if they were at an FMU scale, they would still tend to concentrate probably in a particular sub-catchment within that FMU. So even if it was around the FMU, my take is that it would probably be in a particular part of the FMU, i.e. a sub-catchment, and there would be some, and that rotation, or new rotation that wasn't there, then it's still going to involve, from a nitrogen perspective at least, at the very, probably as a minimum, it's going to be doubling the amount of nitrogen loss from that land.
And you're talking about CVP expansion when you're referring to that figure 8?
Even if it was rotating into a new area that didn't have CVP currently, then that would be, at a local scale, that would be new CVP into that particular area.
Yeah. But I guess in speaking in generalities, we have to be a bit careful about quantifying it, like doubling or whatever, don't we?
Sorry, I don't
understand. You're saying it'll double, but wouldn't it? It would really depend on the how much is rotating, where it's rotating to, where it's come from, things like that. You couldn't generally say it's going to double.
Oh.
Even if you're just rotating, but you're not expanding, you wouldn't be saying double.
Exactly.
In that case.
And it might more than double if it's down in the lower parts of the FMU, or I think average irrigation is in the 30s.
Sure. So, given your concern, I guess, is that you're thinking CVP is going to concentrate in specific areas, whether it's FMU or sub-catchment scale, that makes it less important to that makes it less of an issue, doesn't it, to allow it to happen at the FMU scale. So it sounds like your concern isn't really crop rotation happening at that larger scale. That's not really what you're worried about, is it?
And I still take back my attention to this question on crop rotations.
Okay, today as well, you can't really, don't feel able to take it any further.
The main thing was on sort of, I guess the main point that I was wanting to comment on in the joint witness statement was when this was going to be new. And so that's why rotations, I don't quite keep my head around what is the current state of rotations versus what is proposed as a state of rotation, and whether those rotations then go into areas where they don't currently rotate, whether that actually constitutes for that particular, at that local scale, for all intents and purposes, new contaminant discharge that wasn't there previously. So there might be, wherever you're averaging that FMU net, no net increase, there can be a localized increase in whether there's going to be some susceptibilities or issues relating to that.
But in fairness, you're responsibly saying, look, I'm no expert in crop rotation.
Correct.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Fuchs.
I did have a series of questions this morning regarding variations from 15% to 10% slope in light of the document handed out by council this afternoon. I'm not sure whether those questions are still pertinent or not, but I just wanted to clarify in terms of the amended Schedule C that you're aware has been proffered on behalf of some of the parties. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am aware of it.
You're aware of it.
I sat down.
And perhaps that answers my question, because I did want to know whether you had input into this in relation to your area of water quality expertise.
I knew there were some discussions going on, but I always state that I don't change anything in my evidence. I still believe that we ultimately, from a technical perspective, that the higher that slope threshold, then you'll be there'll be greater coverage of the stream network, and so then there should be more benefits that would accrue from from excluding stock. And saying that, I come from a technical standpoint, and sometimes scientists don't always think about practical matters. We think we do, we try to, but in this case here, there's probably, I understand there's been a lot of discussion around the practical implementations, and even in my efforts, I think I was quite smart and I could easily produce a 10 to 15 degree mat when I did try and look at the version that we produced. I think it's a good enough one to, I think, across all the overs and unders, across something like the 1.1 million hectares of PC1, we can sort of still do an analysis to find out how much land might be above 10 degrees. But when you looked at it at the level at which it needs to be used by farms, it needed some work.
Thank you. I think that qualification you placed on a scientific view, not taking into account always practicalities, that should be a strength, not a weakness, I would have thought, given there are other experts and witnesses who can address issues of practicality and the importance of your expertise in terms of the water quality is to say what the science says and what the science demands, and the extent of delivery is for others, isn't it? That's fair.
Thanks.
Now, when you did address the issue of the slope threshold in your evidence, and I'm looking around paragraph 6.23 and thereabouts, you talked about reducing the slope threshold from 15 to 10 degree increases the area of dry stock land potentially exempt from excluding stock from 63,990 hectares to 113,792 hectares, an increase of 49,790 hectares, or 80%. So that shift, which is now reflected in the proposal that's been advanced by certain parties, maintains that that exclusion doesn't, is approximately 50,000 hectares that are exempt from the obligations in relation to the exclusion of stock. That's what that still remains valid, doesn't it? As a proposition. You've said potentially, because it's your
qualifier. Yes, and just the 6.23, which I've estimated is 49,000, I think we are in agreement with the two GIS analyses that I have discussed with Dr. Lemire, and it's 13% of dry stock.
Right.
That sort of represents. So yes, as far as I don't do the GIS, I am struck that they're rather a chap at work sort of thing to do it. So quite absolutely, that 49,000 hectares is something that it's my best estimate anyway of the land that sits between the two thresholds, 13%.
Now, we'll obviously add some reference also to the more recent available LIDAR approach to mapping, or that modelling. And I presume when you did your 15% slope map, which was which attached to the amended version of plan change ones attached to your council's level submissions, that wasn't using that methodology, was it?
No, we tried to reproduce the one that Manak and Fenelman did for MFE, and that was using the MFE's supplied 15-metre DE.
Do you have any instinct about if one applied the LIDAR, which is a much more specific design standard than by meter analysis, as to whether that exclusion area of 49,000 would increase or decrease with the greater precision of the mapping?
I think it would. I think there's from looking at the overlay on farm, but I think, you know, the MF, because of it to smooth that map, I think it actually does probably capture maybe a little bit more than 10 degrees anyway. So I think if you're something that was really, we're kind of saying it would be more accurate, but I think as you go to more accuracy, you still need to smooth it. And so I don't know whether that accuracy would be false accuracy or not. I guess I'd be, from what I've understood from reading the farmer's evidence, is that from the ones who have had the low and medium sort of MFE overlays put on their property, they've been reasonably comfortable with what the information has been on there. So that's why I wonder, is there a lot to achieve that you get from a 1 metre one? Because I think I was just trying to read this afternoon, but the OIA documents on that when they redeveloped from the first gen slope maps to this current one, that was part of the issue, was over how much do you average it by? Because, you know, if you just did 1 metre by metre, you get that and you don't want that. It's that thing as to what you're going to, still not quite sure what the actual distance is, whether it's 15 or 20 metres with the averaging pointers, but I think those are the nuances of people that know what they're doing in that sort of space to produce useful map layers. And like I say, I've seen the MFE slope layers do seem quite useful when you look at them superimposed on the farm.
And obviously, with those observations in mind, one before you fear of using counting. I'm not saying it's a preferable option necessarily, but do you think there would be some utility, and even if we're running at 10 degree slopes, and noting that the proposal here is to use the Ministry of the Environment low slope map or any replacement map produced by the regional council, that there might be some utility in at least producing a lighter map at 10 degrees or 15 degrees, and just look at that utility question in terms of the comparison of what it might show.
That's right. I don't want to poo-poo sort of science endeavour. You know, so if there's something you can do that's going to be useful and deemed by landowners to be better, then I'm all for it. I guess from a from a Dairy NZ perspective, where we have to, I have to sort of think about things from a dairies across the country. So I guess there's a certain consistency in a regulatory sort of sense if there can be an accepted national mapping layer. And I've got to say, I don't know why or whether they looked at a 15-degree slope map. That would have been what would have been handy, as if there was a low, medium, high, but there didn't seem to be a high that was produced. It was just the 0 to 5 and 5 to 10.
And going back to the science of putting that issue of practicality to one side, obviously, that issue of exclusion and linked to that issue of setbacks is important regardless of slope, isn't it?
Yes.
All about policies.
Yes.
Now, I just was looking at, again, participation in the expert conference, in which one of my friends has touched on. Now, I know that your evidence doesn't address the issue of wetlands and you can participate in a wetlands conference, and I presume that's because that's not an area of expertise.
No, I wouldn't say I was a wetlands specialist, no.
So, better not to comment.
I think it's probably safer than
And if I can just take you to the water quality conference, and you've got that handy, I think you've heard that before, and just looking at page 401.0024.
Sorry, what's the question?
That question, 37. I'm often asked that question, so on page 401.0024, for those looking at that version, this is what's the technical evidence for and against minimum setback distances. And the management agreement, you were a party to this. In general terms, larger setbacks provide greater protection for freshwater ecosystems, not necessarily a linear relationship. In some cases, there is a diminishing return with increasing distance. Now, you've provided a comment of a matter of disagreement on the next page. With respect to point one, we note that, as evident from the shape of the curves and the figure that's noted there, the relationship between buffer width and efficacy is non-linear, and in all cases, we have diminishing returns with increasing buffer width. So, again, that's not a matter of disagreement in terms of exclusion, but rather about the linear nature of the food you said back here.
That wasn't a matter of disagreement, that was just a comment.
Oh, it was a comment, sorry. Yes. I should have read that more. That heading was dropped off the top of the page. That's a comment, very good. And in paragraph 2 of the matters of agreement, you know the minimum setback, the experts have noted the minimum setback distance is a judgment call that needs to be made, balancing the scale of water quality improvement required, the effectiveness of mitigation, and its cost. Now, apropos of the matter we discussed earlier, that issue of cost is that's not a water quality or a scientific perspective, is it? That's just observing there is another factor that might be relevant.
Absolutely, yeah. We scientists argue about just the shape of those curves. Obviously, there's four shapes of those, four curves, these sort of things. So, even that's a contentious enough with operating cost.
Thank you. Now, I did notice in your rebuttal evidence, paragraph 2.46, which is on page 306.0231. I should repeat the right paragraph number. 2.39, apologies. Page open in the wrong place. 2.39 on page 306.0230. You're dealing here, it's under the heading in the femoral streams, but you say you agree with Ms. McArthur in paragraph 89 regarding the importance of protecting small headwater streams, as these are the most abundant and most strong connected to the affected by surrounding land use. You also agree that intermittent streams, but not ephemeral streams, flow past will by definition contain no water for significant amounts of the year. And when dry, they're still afforded the same protection as a permanent stream. So I understand that in paragraphs that follow, your differentiation of yours around ephemeral streams and flow paths as opposed to permanent and intermittent stream. That's
great. I think for me, in the pastoral context, as we're talking, I believe that ephemeral flow paths are actually in the terrestrial environment as part of that continuum. So I don't even talk about ephemeral streams myself. I think they are flow paths.
Right. So we're putting ephemeral streams to life size, and we're at differentiation like that. You agree that aside, that it's really important to protect these small headwater streams within this sub-area.
As some of the reasons, even myself, when I think of headwater streams, you're kind of thinking of up in the hills, but a lot of those headwater streams are actually less than 5 degrees. You know, because obviously, that's the majority of the land is sort of in that, in the low slope map, and that, of course, there's headwater streams all through there. So those headwater streams, all those headwater streams are in the 0 to 10, which is a lot. So those headwater streams are protected. So yes, to answer your question, sorry, going off on a tangent. Yes.
Yes, and you make no comments in your evidence, in chief, or your rebuttal in relation to this issue with the width of streams, and whether streams less, whether 1 metre is a differentiator or not, because from a water quality perspective, if I was looking again at that, that's not a differentiator. The issue of differentiation that people are advancing is a question of practicality and cost, isn't it?
Correct, that's my understanding.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan. Thank you.
Thank you.
I
think that's everyone. Any re-examination?
No, Your Honour. If I could take you to paragraph 3.2 in your evidence of the chief. Sorry, can everyone hear? You need a microphone. So the point you're trying to make there is that once the clean water that leaves Lake Taupo, as it goes downstream and collects more tributary flows, and so the effect of that clean water becomes less and less downstream, or it has less and less influence on the water quality of the main stem.
That's right, yes.
Okay. Further down on that same page, 3.5. You talk about the idea that the dairy land use is treated in a regulatory more stringent fashion than other land uses. So what would it, just turning that around, how are other land uses treated less stringent? What does that look like? What's the nature of that stringency?
That's probably best answered by Mr. Willis. But in terms of, just to give you a brief answer, that was the fact that the drafting gap and intensity was based on nitrogen. So there's sort of a nitrogen focus on that, and my understanding was that it was based on that sort of nitrogen assessment. That was where the dairy went through different consenting regimes or something. I haven't really looked at Willis's evidence for a while, but he covers that in much better detail. He could ask that question better than I could.
So would you have to go to proffer an opinion about what might be done to balance things up a bit so that there isn't so much attention on nitrogen in your view?
Well, I do think some of, that's why I think Scott exclusion has been, and what I can't remember the paragraph number now, but twice, I think, certainly in terms of a mitigation on pastoral land, that's right, I think stock exclusion through, E. coli, certainly E. coli, phosphorus and sediment, is applicable across all across the pastoral patch and sort of thing. So I think that does, having those minimum standards and that requirement of things, I think, and from my perspective, is levelling, your terminology, levelling that playing field a bit. As a water quality scientist, I think it's a really encouraging step to see a mitigation like that being applied to streams, given that it's regarded as being such an important step in improving freshwater outcomes for streams and productive catchments.
Stock exclusion is already there.
Yep.
But am I interpreting from what you're saying in terms of rebalancing the over emphasis on here in your view that you would like more stock exclusion?
I think.
and if so, in what sort of amount? More streams, wider setbacks.
No, I think some of the origins of that comment that I've made in there, I think it stems from the fact that we, in a regulatory sense, with oats here, we are quite nitrogen centric, because nitrogen is that only thing that we've been able to, when we set that classic thing that the NPCFM required us to set a target, and is an in-stream target, we want to have an outcome. What are the things we need to set to achieve those outcomes? Nitrogen is one of them. So we set a nitrogen number, so like 500 in the lower white cattle. And PC1 is not being looking at allocation. So then when allocation happens, at least that's a... Sorry, that's my train of thought. Damn it. I just got to go off on tangents. Now we're just thinking. Sorry, what was the question? I was going to get there, but I got lost.
You can raise your mind. I'm just talking now.
Oh, okay. So my apologies.
Yes. More stock exclusion, or stock exclusion with different characteristics than is already in the plan.
Yeah, no, that's what I was saying. I still think that probably my comment more reflects that I think that we have a nitrogen-centric focus, because when we want to allocate, we can, in a nice and tidy budgeting sort of way, we can say, right, we need to have this much of a reduction. We know that properly scale nitrogen is this much, so we can then go and apply clawbacks, sort of thing. Whatever allocation framework is done, we get to do that with nitrogen. So I think that's my perception anyway, is that there tends to be regulatory process that it tends to be a little bit nitrogen centric, even whether or not nitrogen is actually the key contaminant of concern in terms of trying to meet some of the freshwater outcomes that PC1 is trying to do. I think we've heard it from and Dr. O'Shea's evidence and my evidence talking about that the water quality variables that are from a spatial extent the most overallocated, and from a magnitude respect the most overallocated tend to be coal mine sediment. So, sorry if I haven't answered your question.
I've got a few more questions to go. Do you want to run?
It's 5 o'clock. Yes, all right. Are you available tomorrow, Dr. Crick?
Just saying.
Very good. Well, I think we will take a break there then. Now, I don't know if you've given evidence in the court before. At this stage in the questioning, you're no longer under cross-examination, and so the restrictions that might otherwise apply to you talking with counsel or others don't apply, so you are able to talk to people. However, if somebody says, oh, this is the way you ought to deal with what the commission is trying to get you to say, you should say, well, I really shouldn't talk to you about that.
Understood.
Good, very good.
Any housekeeping matters? Mr. Mance, what do you have to
Thank you, Right, I'm just conscious there's a few more parties and then the Federated Farmers Cups,
yes.
And I just need to make travel arrangements for some of them potentially for
right.
tomorrow. And we have one witness, I assume we've got Mr. Dr. Dupree, as well as
yes.
Lockhill, Mr. Now.
Yes.
We have one farmer witness, Mr. Guyton, 304 tab 2 and 3.
Yes.
Because of his work commitments, if it were possible to get him on tomorrow, even in advance of the legal submission, that would be appreciated.
Let me just check and see. Is there anyone present at the moment who would be intending to cross examine Mr. Guyton? And it may well be, if there's only no cross-examination or a very limited amount of cross-examination, then certainly we can deal with that in the ordinary way.
Yep.
I would have thought, from the list you just read out, which is what I thought might be about as much as we could deal with, we could accommodate him on that basis.
I think, to be fair, he also would like to. It's an important issue he would like to present, but I don't.
I understand that he'd like to present. You'll probably explain to him that we have got
yeah.
his evidence, we've
yeah.
read his evidence, and that him taking time to make a speech to us may not be as persuasive as not doing so.
Especially at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon.
Well, as time goes by, and the very last thing that I would want to do would be to cut him off
yeah.
at about 4:15 or 4:15, and so I'm very sorry that we've got to go.
No, I understand. And, Your Honour, it's not, I appreciate the other parties need to come to you. It's about 2 hours away, so we might just.
Well,
I'm
more than happy for you to have a discussion with those who are here who may well say, look, if he can be here, for example, straight after lunch or something like that. And I'm just going to check again, but we can slot him in. Mr. Fisher, do you think you've got some questions for him?
If I do, it'll be very, very few, sir.
Okay. Any other parties like to have questions, Ms. Ogman?
Yes, I'm sorry, sir. I may have his.
Yeah, all right. Oh, that's fine. You might just want to think about how long it could roughly be, but as I say, I would hope that. The first thing would be to conclude Dr. Dupree's evidence, and then we've got Mr. Willis, who I suspect is likely to be the longest in the witness box tomorrow, so I think we need to make a start with him. Confer with your friends about that, and I'm sure we can make some arrangements.
Thank you very much.
And I should just say to the parties that the order as it is in this list, as everybody is probably aware, is not fixed. If there's an adjustment that needs to be made, then obviously we can make that adjustment.
And just to be clear, so I can let Mr. Thompson know as well, I'm assuming there's no realistic likelihood of us opening our case tomorrow from a legal submission perspective.
I don't see that as being at all likely.
That's good. Thank you.
Well, I don't know. There's people think I'm being too pessimistic, but I think realistically. I would imagine that if I were to poll everybody about questions for Mr. Willis, there'd be quite a bit, and I think that, as I say, that has to be the priority.
That's my take. Thank you.
Very good. Anything else? No? All right. We'll be starting at 9:30 tomorrow. Thank you.
Yeah.